I don't know. I don't know anymore. I don't know anymore about anything. I really don't. I used to be like like this and comic books and jerking off. I don't know. It's all fascinating.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Los Angeles, California, I am Cassidy Robinson, and with me today is friend of the show, Patrick, from the podcast Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational.
Hello, I'm from Metro Detroit, like where RoboCop lives. Except for that was filmed in Dallas.
Was it?
Yeah, I'm almost positive.
Of course it was.
Yeah, exactly.
If not Dallas, then like Orange County or something like that.
There's plenty of rubble he could have shot out here, which would have fit in fine.
Funnily enough, now Detroit has become a more popular area for Hollywood to shoot films because it's cheaper.
It is exactly
that. So all of these kind of like third tier cities like Detroit, Atlanta, places like that are being popular film shoot locations now because it's too expensive to get the licenses in L.A.
I may or may not have seen the Batmobile when it was filmed down here by the old Packard plant.
Which Batmobile?
The one from Batman v Superman.
Oh, they did a little bit of shooting there.
They did. That final scene where it's all in darkness and they're fighting the troll monster.
Mm-hmm.
from Lord of the Rings. That was all filmed here, I believe.
Yeah. And in case listeners have never, maybe some of your listeners have never listened to this show before, you have been on ours before to discuss Batman v Superman.
I have been. And you guys have been on both shows. You yourself, you might hold the record for someone talking to me the most at this point. Second most. Mm-hmm. Other than Dennis and my father.
Now that it's a tight race.
It's a very tight race. Yeah, I've had you on both shows. You are an old friend of the show. I was really excited about talking with you this week about movies in general.
Mm-hmm. And this week I had you on specifically because we're going to be talking about a comic book related film, the Trolls movie.
Right, exactly. I'm sure there was an IDW tie-in comic at some point of the Trolls that was published very hastily.
That's the second time I've done that joke with you and it's still funny. No, we're going to be talking about Doctor Strange, Marvel's Doctor Strange. I'm going to be reviewing the independent film Moonlight. And at the end of the show, we're going to review Pervert Park, which is a documentary that you chose.
I did.
On Netflix.
That's Netflix homework for you.
That's for me. Now, you said you had a surprise for me. You wanted to spring something on me. What is it?
I do. Oh, I was just cleaning out my emails and I realized I had sent an email to you way back that was never read on the show.
I should have known.
August 22nd. So I will read this email to you so you and the listeners can hear it. Hello, fellas. Since you always say that I do this. I have a stream of consciousness with my emails. And so mm-hmm. I labeled this one like 179, episode 179, Suicide Squad. You asked the last show if your reviews reflect the film you reviewed. Yep, they essentially do, and I love it. I have no idea what I'm referencing at this point. You review it. Also, my English and syntax is horrible, so bear with. Oh, your review was two-third a good film, was spot on, with a final act, had the stink of Warner Brothers all over it. I think I was talking about Suicide Squad. Yeah. I have no idea how you can bungle the concept of this film. It's Ocean's 11 or Dirty Dozen with supervillains. Just let them be villains and send them into a quasi-military-style mission. No backstory. Just throw it up on the screen and let it play out. This is a question for you guys. Have either of you seen the DC animated stuff?
Oh, are you asking me in person?
Yeah, I'm asking now in person.
Yeah, I have the Dark Knight, not Dark Knight Rises, the Dark Knight Returns mm-hmm. DVD. Like, it comes with both parts one and part two.
Yep.
And actually, at the time, that was released right around the same time that Nolan's Dark Knight Rises came out. And I thought that it did a better job at being that movie than Nolan's Dark Knight Rises.
I can absolutely agree, and I'll go on to explain my email from August 22nd. 90% of it is pitch perfect. They know the audience wants to see The Flash, Batman, Green Lantern, and Wonder Woman smash shit for 85 minutes. And that's what you get. Them smashing shit for 85 minutes, and people seem to adore it. Maybe DC only belongs on the silver screen. By the way, co-host Dennis saw the film with me and loved it. Absolutely.
Which film?
Suicide Squad.
Okay.
He absolutely loved it. He only knew of one character, Harley Quinn, from the animated series. The rest of them, he said, this guy, and that one woman with a sword. That was his review. Then I just went on. I'll wrap it up. 180 Sausage Party. Refused to see this. I expected to be filled with juvenile, random swearing, sex, chicks, and ethnic stereotypes. These are one of those that I'm glad you watched for me. I enjoyed the. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is something that you need to keep doing, though. I enjoyed the acid reflux story a great deal. I do want Cassidy's health corner each week.
Maybe, oh, man. That could go deep.
Maybe Cassidy has diarrhea, hangnails, shingles, and a pack of molar tails in the future, and he ties it in with the film. Please keep the emails coming, Richard, and go watch some DC animated on Netflix. That was
right.
End of email. Sorry.
No, that's good. That's great. You bring content. That's what a good guest should do.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Is to bring content to the show. I also wanted to talk a little bit about I went to Comic-Con recently, or now, it used to be called Stanley's Kamikaze,
mm-hmm.
and this year is the first year they've called it Stanley Presents LA Comic-Con.
Mm.
So I don't know what that means. I don't know if that means that nobody knew what Kamikaze meant.
That's a great
because
name.
It's not a yeah, and it's spelled like differently, obviously. But it's a comic convention that is not owned by the same affiliation that does San Diego or WonderCon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not Comic-Con per se, but I guess they were able to get around the legal rules or whatever trademark that they had to be able to call it Comic-Con.
Do you know if it's Wizard, like the old comic, like card magazine Wizards?
Wizard World?
Yeah, Wizard World. It's not a Wizard World show, is it?
No, Wizard World, I don't think that has any affiliation with Comic-Con either.
I don't think so. No, I know it doesn't for sure.
Yeah, but that's a smaller one. That happens in Chicago, right?
Yeah, well, that's C2E2 now, which I went to a couple of years ago. But they don't – no, they – like, well, Chicago would be like – you know, if you said it's in L.A. County and you drove all the way down to like – let me see if I can do my California geography. Like the southern end of Orange County, you're like, yeah, that's Chicagoland. Like it would be okay. As possibly – it's like the Roseland Arena, which is an hour outside of Chicago.
Oh, okay. So it's a suburb.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like an entire county away.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. But yeah, you know, this was the first year that I went as press. Technically, I sent in a press packet of the places that I write for, that I freelance for, and that was good enough for them. So I actually was able to get in for free, which was cool. And I was hoping that I could find some comic creators, some maybe low level comic creators or something like that to interview or possibly have on the show. And maybe at some point I still will. But I did talk to, maybe you'll find this entertaining, I did talk to Steve Niles.
I do know it. Yeah.
The horror comic writer of 30 Days of Night was probably the most popular thing he did. But I've actually not read that much stuff from him other than 30 Days of Night. What I wanted to talk to him about is that he was the bass player, I think, in a DC hardcore band called Grey Matter in the mid-80s.
Oh, really?
And another band called Three, both of which released albums on Discord. So he's he comes out of that whole same scene, Ian MacKaye and Fugazi and all of that stuff, during their really political era in the mid-80s. And I wanted to talk to him mostly about that. So I brought a DVD of a documentary I reviewed called Salad Days, A History of DC Hardcore. And I had him sign 30 Days of Night and was I think I bought something on the table that he signed so I didn't feel like a complete weirdo.
That always helps.
And then I put down the DVD just to see what his reaction would be. And I guess he hasn't even seen it yet. He's like, oh, wow, we have to get one of these still. He was talking to his, who I think was his significant other, who was sitting with him.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that's the best way to get to know those people. Like Jeff Lemire, who is from across the river here and lives in Ontario in Essex.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he's a huge Red Wings fan. And he went to I can't remember, it was local con here, it was Motor City Con or whatever. And he's got a real big thing he does these Star Wars tie-ins for juveniles. mm-hmm. like their comic books, like Jedi Academy. And so all these kids are coming and talking to them. And I just came up to them at the time, like Mike Babcock was the coach being fired. And I was like, hey, who are they going to replace Babcock with? And his eyes just like lit up. He's all excited. And he started, like, just started talking about like
right
all of Red Wings hockey for the past 10, 15 years, which I don't follow that closely, but I just knew he'd be excited about it. And of course, mm-hmm. he just did like a Free Vader sketch for me and everything else. I was like, all right, now I just got to find everything else that everyone likes. It's not, you know, whatever they're drawing at the time and talking to them about. But that's how you mm-hmm. get and go with those people.
Yeah, you know, and that wasn't just like a tactic to try and like
no.
woo him or whatever. I mean, that's literally what I was more interested in talking about because I love a lot of that stuff. But yeah, I wanted, going off the discussion of kamikaze, have you ever been able to convince your dad to go to a con?
Oh,
because you should describe a little bit. What do you do for your show?
Oh, okay. Make Dad Read Comics is exactly what it sounds like. My dad's 60, about to be 68 years old. He used to think that the only two people, oddly enough, which fits in our Netflix homework, were that read comics were pedophiles, like brain damaged, or like just stoners who just like had no get up and go. And then I guess me as the outlier who seemed to read them still.
You're one of the good ones.
One of the good ones, exactly. And I just said, you know, like, have you ever tried to read one of these things? And he said, no. And then so the show was a weekly quest to sit down with my dad and teach him some aspect of comics.
Mm-hmm.
And he's finally to a part where he actually enjoys reading them. Like, it took 3 years to do that alone. I've taken him to Free Comic Book Day. I took him to some local signings.
Mm-hmm.
But when I brought it up, and the problem was when he looked at it, he just saw everyone in, like, cosplay. And
yeah.
he saw the long lines. And just the people, and he was like, oh, come on, Patrick, we can't go to that. And I was like, well, why can't we go to that? And he was like, look at these people. Look at these people. I was like, these are just regular Americans, Dad, having fun. And then I said, well, what's the difference between, like, you know, a Green Bay Packers hat, you know, wearing a cheese hat and things like that? And my dad was like, they're morons too. I wouldn't want to sit in line with them. So I was like, well, fair enough. But I might have convinced them to go to this one because I did the same thing you did. I submitted press pass stuff.
Mm-hmm.
For like the podcast, and like one of the female organizers got back to me, and she was like, "Well, we can cut you to only two." I was greedy; I asked for four. And then she was like, "Well, we can cut you two, maybe." And I was like, "Do I take my fiance or do I take my dad?" Because I know if my dad gets there, like he just has a low level for shit. Like he just like if anything, like a line or anyone is in a costume wants him to take a picture, like. He'll just be done and gone. Like he's at the age now where he just has no time for that nonsense anymore.
Right, right.
But I would think he'd be fascinated, his mind would be blown.
Well, you know, I mean, obviously kamikaze is really far from you guys, but it does differ from some of the other cons, or at least the ones around here, because it's less about the fans
mm-hmm.
and it's a little bit more about, I mean, there's a big, you know, go and buy shit, aspect of it mm-hmm. as there is for every con, and there's a lot of like celebrities and lines to be had and that kind of stuff, but all of the panels are usually geared toward aspiring writers, aspiring industry, because it's LA and it's all about how do you get in, who are the people you talk to, what are the different kinds of ways to self-publish, and that kind of stuff. It seems to be dominating the panels at kamikaze versus WonderCon or the others.
Well, let me that see that, that's something I'd be interested in. I know he'd be interested in, like
yeah, I think that like I don't think he would be that interested in the sales floor aspect of it, where everybody's kind of peacocking around in their cosplay costumes that they made at home. But I think he might be more interested in the professional side of it.
Yeah, he's fascinated by that.
I also thought of it as thought about you guys in conjunction to a con, because of any of the podcasts, like comic book related podcasts that out there that do like live recordings, Make Dad Read Comics would be live recording convention gold.
It really would.
I mean, like that. Like I thought about like doing like if I were to be popular enough to draw an audience, my show would be the most boring show and awkward show to do for a live audience, because essentially it's about having a conversation with one person. There's no reaction.
Right.
And so to try and like perform a podcast would be really bizarre for Jabber and the Drone. Mm-hmm. But Make Dad Read Comics is designed to be done live at conventions.
You know what? You sold me. I'm going to make him go. I'm going to bring the portable stuff that I've upgraded, all that stuff. We're going to try to do it.
I bet you could definitely, like, if you describe the show and show them your Google Analytics and stuff, you could probably get an exhibitor pass and maybe get a small, like, convention room to be able to do it.
Oh, this is now you've sparked a fire. in my mind, Cassie. I'm honestly gonna try it because I think the only thing is I'll have to. Like, my dad's got gremlin rules. Like, you can't get him wet. You can't feed him after midnight.
Right.
Like, you know, I'm gonna warn him. Like, if he gets bored and wants to walk away, he's gonna get bored and walk away. Like I can't control what he's gonna do at any point. I think with people in front of him, he would calm down.
I bet he would like it. Like, hearing, like, you know, you open the show, talk about the show, then getting the audience reaction and that kind of stuff. I bet he would get into it more than he thinks he would.
That's a good idea. I'm writing all this down on pencil paper because I'm a Luddite as I'm saying this. So if you hear a pen hit the ground once or the floor once in a while, that's why.
Let's go ahead and just get into Doctor Strange. I'll talk about Moonlight afterward. Why don't you go ahead and set it up? Because I think you have more specifics of these characters.
Okay. Doctor Strange, Dr. Stephen Vincent Strange, was created in 1963 out of Strange Tales, number 110. It was an anthology comic where they would just try out characters, like Ant-Man would come out of that and different things. All these characters, I think people forget, the original characters like Spider-Man, other than Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, Ant-Man, even Namor, all those characters that now are, you know, front and center from the very first boom of what Liberty Comics and the Marvel Comics were, all came out of these, like, one-off stories. Mm-hmm. He's originally written by Stan Lee and Steve Ditko, the legendary Steve Ditko, who is a whole story in himself of, like, an escape artist and comic book artist. Mm-hmm. Published this weird – I mean, he's, like, D-list. So fast forward now to 2016. The movie comes out. Do you want me to do the traditional thing where I run down what the basic premise of the film is?
Yeah. What's this – trailer selling us?
Okay, the trailer selling is Dr. Stephen Strange, an arrogant neurosurgeon who pushes away everyone, including the love of his life, who is, I forget the woman's name, she's played by Rachel McAdams, mm-hmm. Love interest number one, and goes off after a horrible accident where he only cares about fame and fortune, not fixing people because that's the right thing to do and do no harm, a Hippocratic oath, injures his hand severely, and medical science can no longer fix him. His hands mm-hmm. have such nerve damage he can never perform surgery again. He spends all his money and travels to Kathmandu out east to find the Ancient One and the mystical metaphysical arts to heal his hands and his soul, and it comes upon there is a mystical war going on, and he must defend Earth and the Sanctum Sanctorum, more specifically, against this mystical threat, Dormammu, who exists in some nebulous fourth world.
Right.
Did I sum it up pretty well?
That's perfect. Thank you. And the film is directed by Scott Derrickson. But this is why I was specifically interested in this movie by Marvel, is because Scott Derrickson comes from a horror background. Most famously, he did the movie Sinister. Mm. Before that, he did The Exorcism of Emily Rose, and a long time ago, he did a direct-to-DVD Hellraiser sequel called Hellraiser Inferno, which is one of the better Hellraiser sequels, actually, because it's basically, it takes the premise of a film noir with a detective who even has, like, inner monologue and everything, with, it's just, he ends up, like, getting into Hellraiser shit.
Okay.
And it's actually a fun sequel to that franchise. A little under budget, and it's not like a great movie, but better than it should have been.
Okay.
And I thought Sinister was really scary for what it was. It had a really pedestrian screenplay, but I thought that Derrickson brought a lot of style to it, and he was really good at building tension. And he, again, like a lot of those Blumhouse movies, the better ones, he knows how to tell a really familiar story really well. I never saw Exorcism of Emily Rose, but people like it. So I thought, okay, so you have Doctor Strange, which is taking all this mystical stuff, all this occulty stuff, and you're going to plug Scott Derrickson into that. That's really interesting. Maybe mm-hmm. we'll have something a little darker than the usual Marvel fare. Maybe it'll be a little bit more kind of leaning towards something that's a little outside of their genre comfortabilities of, like, the big action spectacle. That's not the movie I thought I got.
No,
isn't necessarily their fault. That's more my problem for having those kind of expectations. But I feel like my biggest criticisms of Doctor Strange, which is fine as far as the Marvel superhero movies go, the Marvel Studios that's ran by Disney and Kevin Feige, it's in line with the, you know, middle top to the best of what they are able to do. But I thought that it was basically the same story they keep telling. This is essentially the same story that Iron Man was. Egotistical, fame-seeking man has to learn to put aside his own ego for the greater good. which was essentially the same story that Thor was, which is, you know, again, repeated here. And as well as all of this works, it's a pretty well-oiled genre machine. And there's some great visuals that come out of the movie. I saw it in 3D, and it's a fun 3D movie to see. A lot of trippy stuff that's kind of this post, Matrix, post, Inception sort of cities folding in on each other, M.C. Escher looking stuff. That's all fun. And as a thrill ride, it's fine. But my problem with the Marvel machine, the Marvel factory at this point, is they have such a huge body of work now that just fine doesn't cut it for me anymore. And if I'm grading on a curve, it's only about the middle of what I think they're capable of doing. And if Marvel movies are the now I'm ranting. It's okay. If the Marvel movies are the only conversation that the general public is having about cinema as a whole anymore, whether it's in a doctor's office or at a film school, that basically that's the only thing people are talking about, then I feel that they have a responsibility to challenge their form. What did you think?
Okay. Interestingly, I mean, there's a lot there. There's a lot I agreed with in there. There's some I didn't. Some I didn't. Some I'll retort to.
We can get into the specifics.
Okay. The first thing is, I did not know anything about Derek. What's his name? I almost call him Derek Robertson, who just passed away. He's a really good comic book artist. Scott Derrickson. I didn't know he directed horror films or anything like that. Again, this is stuff you would know going in. This is me. Like, I know who 2/3 of the cast are. And then right. Kevin Feige's producer. I know that when I go into these films.
Right. And the general public shouldn't know about that or worry about that. That was, again, like I said, that's more on me for creating expectations that couldn't necessarily be met.
But interestingly enough here, whenever I watch these Marvel films, the reason I like a lot of them is because they're a genre within a genre. Captain America is like espionage. And the first one's a historical war film. Thor's fantasy. Iron Man, even though it's the template of the superhero story, is really a kind of that third film is like a buddy action film to a huge degree. They have like these little subgenres. So I was excited that this was going to be a medical kind of mystery thing. I know it sounds weird because he is a doctor and there's a lot of things in the comic books he performs where he's like a magical doctor. Or I thought that it would also be something about, I don't know if they would go full on horror, but I thought it would have a tinge of the supernatural and horror to it.
Right. Or and there was a culty kind of.
Yes, thing. Exactly. And there's none of that in here. It's very paint by numbers superhero story, which is not bad in itself. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that if that's what you're going to make, but so much the rest of the stuff isn't that. Like if I want to see a paint by numbers superhero film, I go see the big ones, the Avengers. I think the two films were just, you know, I mean, those are like comic books brought to life. They have like a 5-act structure of a comic book within them. There's like almost all of it is done in a comic book style. This is not done in a comic book style, but it's also not done what I expected, the subgenre stuff. That, I mean, there's that Peter Max like Steve Ditko homage where Tilda Swinton sends him back on that trippy trip. And I was like, okay, here's where we're going to get, you know, a lot of horrific, weird things crawling out. And they make mention of there's horrible things in the mirror universe. They're going to come get you. But we never see any of that stuff. Like there's never any monstrous, creepy things that he must fight back, which he does all the time in the comic books. I mean, that he typically fights monstrous, horrible things from other dimensions, like Cthulhu-like things. None of that's in here at all. It's just, again, service level comic book bash him up stuff.
Yeah, it's just him versus a bunch of ninjas who shoot things out of their hands.
Yeah, exactly. And the other, to go to the idea of the problem again, when you say like the origin of like, this is like Tony Stark, where he's a guy full of hubris who has to learn humility at some point, or Thor.
Yeah.
There is only two superhero origin stories. I mean, be perfectly honest. There's tragedy where the character, you know, Peter Parker's, Uncle Ben's killed or Batman's parents are killed and he must overcome that. Or the rest of them are all men, typically women too. Now there's a lot of women like, Carol Danvers, that Captain Marvel movie is going to come out. I guarantee the entire crux of it, of her finding redemption, is she's an alcoholic and was kicked out of the Air Force and has to, you know, learn humility to get back in the Air Force. I mean, it's always this feet of clay character who is brought low and finds some power to bring them back up. It's very Campbellian.
Yes.
Story structure. So only so much you can do with that. Do you know what I mean? And this is, suffers from that because if you go away from that,
mm-hmm.
and you do what I thought, I can't remember what the film was, but they showed the Hulk. They showed the entire origin of the Hulk in the credit sequence,
mm-hmm.
and then you just got the Hulk doing stuff the rest of the film. Like that's the way to do this. Everyone knows, even if they don't know Doctor Strange, they know the formula for a superhero film. You don't need to even show that first 20 minutes of the film anymore.
Right. Well, I think in the case of Doctor Strange, you don't need to necessarily have the how did he become, like, one of my other issues with the movie is that, and it's an issue I think that they actually handle pretty well considering, mm-hmm. but the movie is chock full of exposition. There's so much to explain here. You have to explain these, you know, these phantom realms. You have to explain the nature of the magic that they're using. You have to explain Dormammu and this, you know, big, expansive universe. Everything is explaining. And actually, on a story level, I was reminded a great deal of the first Matrix.
Mm.
Because that's essentially how that movie works, is you have the Keanu Reeves character, who's this sort of the cipher into the world, and everything's sort of explained to him through these, you know, teaching sequences.
Mm-hmm.
I was also reminded a lot of the first third of Batman Begins.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of that's being mined for this movie. And on a special effects level, obviously Inception is all over this, sort of a Inception on acid.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, they managed to deal with exposition, heavy exposition, pretty well. It never felt like M. Night Shyamalan's Last Airbender disaster, or like David Lynch's Dune, or anything mm-hmm. like that. It never got to that level of like boring and pointless. And they're really good at being able to sell exposition with a lot of jokes to keep it bouncy and light. I feel like the movie, unfortunately, is so jokey that you can never really take any of the magic stuff all that seriously, because mm-hmm. the tone has to remain so light that it allows for the heavy exposition to just float on by. And because of that, the movie is fairly campy, but I guess in a way that it sort of knows it is. Again, I just felt like there was a more interesting movie to be made here. Maybe a deeper movie, maybe a scarier movie, maybe something a little less traditional than what they ended up doing, which is a very Joseph Campbell reluctant hero story.
No, it is. Oh, except for, I really think that last act where he confronts Dormammu and the mansion, that part is, I thought that was pretty bold. Mm-hmm. That was pretty fascinating. I thought they were going to go away. I mean, I don't want to ruin it for anybody, but I hate saying spoiler, but I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but the repetition of that scene over and over again,
mm-hmm.
I thought we were only going to get about a minute of that and then it would be resolved. But they really stayed on that point and hammered it home for a really long period
of
time.
That was one of the more interesting ideas in the screenplay. I'll give you that. And that was an interesting way to end a big superhero blockbuster.
Yeah, I mean, I thought so too.
It meets Kevin Feige's explosion quota.
Oh, it does.
But it actually had a conclusion that was more thoughtful than just they have to blow up the MacGuffin and everyone's mm-hmm. saved. And I felt like on a sequel, if we're thinking about sequels, which we always are with these movies, you could do some really interesting stuff with that idea in particular, as it regards to Stephen Strange's psyche and that kind of things. Again, we'll see if they choose to go that direction, because I'm not the one making these movies.
Right.
But, you know, and it sounds like I'm shitting all over the movie. I'm really not. I had a fun time. It was good. My problem is it's par for the course. And as I said, with the Marvel thing, if this is the only conversation America's having about movies anymore, then I wish they would elevate that conversation.
No, I can see what you're saying. I mean, coming from your area of a movie guy, I'll tell you this from the area of a comic book guy. I really worried about this, like in terms of, I mean, I think people finally realize like when you go to see these movies, you have to suspend a massive amount of disbelief.
Sure. And I think that Marvel's really good at making people do that. I don't think people think about how campy a lot of this is.
Oh, I'm not even saying can't suspend disbelief, but when you go back to the exposition part,
mm-hmm.
like there, you, when you read one of these comic books, they're so dense, about Doctor Strange specifically, and there's so much jargon of mystic mumbo jumbo they actually talk about in it. Mm-hmm. And I was amazed they threw so much of that in there. And they really went deep. I was like, holy crap. They're really good. And they really talked it out. And I think it's sometimes show, don't tell. Like the same thing in a couple, just show what happens at some point. You don't need Mordru and Wong to explain the entire backstory of the library in, large detail. And again, Cassie, I don't know if these movies are always made for us too. You say that all the time in the show because in front of me, there was a whole collection of 7 to 8 year old boys and girls,
mm-hmm.
maybe a dozen of them. And every one of those jokes, like the joke where his hand goes through the portals and grabs the books,
mm-hmm.
they were like enraptured. They were so excited about every bit of that. They were so they were so happy. So if that's your audience for the future, they do a pretty good job reaching out to them.
Yeah, no, the movies are, and this movie in particular is very palatable. It goes down easy. As far as on a formal level, the only issue I had, only script issues I had with the movie is I felt like the rush for him to go from naive to master of the arts goes by in literally three scenes.
Well, Cassie,
in three scenes that go back to back and no montage, literally he he learns how to be the best magician of the entire crew out of being a novice in three scenes.
Cassie, did you not hear that one offhanded line that he has a photographic memory and he learned to astral project so he can read at night? That answered all those plot hole questions in one line.
Right.
I mean those that again, that's where you just have to those are parts where I gotta tell my dad in the show. My dad has a question like that. Comic books. You wave your hands above your head and say comic books. That's all you can say. It's magical realism to the nth degree. Like you just gotta go with it.
Yeah, I didn't take it as a huge problem.
No, I but I know what you mean. In terms of filmmaking, it is a bit lazy and it is a bit almost insulting. Like even up to there going, okay, come on now. Like really? like we're not even gonna attempt to show any kind of progression here whatsoever. We're just gonna jump right in. Again, mm-hmm. that if you're gonna be that lazy about it, don't show him during a training sequence. Don't show him learning. Have him be like year two Doctor Strange. That's fine.
I think that would be the more interesting entry point, personally. And you can even take care of some of the stuff in flashback or in sequences or something. But I mean, I see that the model that they went after, and it's a successful model.
Right.
And if something's not broken, why fix it, I think, is their methodology. As a movie, it runs smoothly. I had a hard time being excited about it as I was walking out. I enjoyed my time at the movies in the most superficial way possible, but I was hoping that, given the subject matter and the director, that it could be a little bit more risky. It could be a little bit more idiosyncratic than it ended up being.
Okay. Then I don't want to make this too long, but can I jump on one last thing I was going to talk about in terms of China?
Sure.
The character of the Ancient One mm-hmm. is shown to be a Celtic white woman.
Yeah.
And this, and originally there were some accusations of whitewashing very early on.
Yeah.
When this was released.
Played by Tilda Swinton.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to be a Tibetan man. But I think the fear was if you released it to China with a Tibetan man playing a central powerful role, especially with control of a Sanctum Sanctorum in Hong Kong, that would not fly well in the Chinese market. Wasn't the director one of the people who flat out said, hey, listen, we got to sell this to the Chinese market. We got to change this character.
Interesting.
I mean,
I never knew the back politics behind it.
Yeah. And I don't want to get in a political soapbox. But I think it was very interesting. The second they came out with that, everyone was like, oh, well, that's okay then. Because we're going to get rid of our cultural wars for capitalism to continue. I kind of rolled my eyes there was this feigned outrage and they just flat out said, yeah, we know, but we want to make money. And everyone just kind of went, oh, okay.
My argument for Tilda Swinton in that role is I think Tilda Swinton transcends race and gender. Tilda Swinton is an elemental that walks among us on this planet. I'm not even sure if she's entirely human, and I love that about her or him. And
that's true.
And I'm fine with her being cast as anything they want to cast her as, no matter how inappropriate.
Okay, then I'm on board. I mean, I just thought it was a very strange bit that popped up, and everyone was just like, nah, don't worry about it. We got to make money. And then no one said boo about it afterward.
Right, right. And I should say, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch does a great job. Tilda Swinton has a thankless role of just delivering exposition, but she does it well because she's Tilda Swinton. Chiwetel Ejiofor is in there, and again, kind of a thankless role, but he makes the most of it as he can. I think Marvel has a villains problem.
Oh, they have a huge villains problem.
And Mads Mikkelsen, I think, is a little wasted in this movie.
Super wasted. He's Hugo Weaving wasted in this one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and I was expecting a little bit more from him, but again, given what has to do, he's in it.
he's physical threat bad guy. That's what he is.
Yeah, with a weird face.
With a weird face. Who says menacing things once in a while.
And again, because of the subject matter, I think you could have made a really interesting, really scary supervillain. It's kind of interesting. I kind of thought about that, and I thought of why didn't they go the dark direction with this movie? And maybe they want to separate themselves from what DC's doing, especially at this point. There could be a lot of reason. I came up ultimately, Marvel's not interested in stories about disaster or stories about the bad things that happen. They're interested in stories about saviors.
Yep. Yeah. And I wonder if that's why there's so much more appealing to DC at this moment.
Mm-hmm. I think people are more interested in that story.
So maybe we're wrong and they're right. I don't know, but I do like bad guys. I like Darth Vader. I want to see a really menacing, nasty bad guy. I want to get, especially when you have this idea of like a religious nihilistic zealot. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have so much to play with there. It's that he's just, you know, scary eyed bad guy.
Yeah. And I think that, closest thing that Marvel's ever had to like a really compelling villain in their movies is Tom Hiddleston's Loki. But even now, they're trying to edge him closer and closer to being an anti-hero.
Yep, exactly. So, yeah, I need to point out before they have a villain problem. I think they do have a villain problem. I think you're right.
Right. So, ultimately, I give Doctor Strange a pass, but I'm not enthusiastic about it.
I will give it more than a pass. It's a fun superhero movie. It just wasn't what I thought the subgenre movie that I thought was going to be.
Fair enough. I think if you're... 13 to 22 years old, and you love seeing these movies because there's something, that kind of joy and enthusiasm that you expect from it, you're going to get that.
Yep, like, I agree.
You are more than likely going to enjoy yourself with the movie.
Yep.
Okay, I'm going to quickly talk about Moonlight, which was released a couple weeks ago and has been getting a lot of pre-Oscar buzz for a lot of the performances and possibly the direction here. This is a independent film written and directed by Barry Jenkins. This is his second feature, but he's mostly worked in shorts up until this point. And it takes place in Florida over a kind of a long span of time as we're looking at this central character named Chiron. Who's growing up as a kind of the poor African American neighborhoods in Florida. And he's a kind of shy and sensitive young boy who's running from bullies all of his life. And he doesn't quite fit in with sort of his urban environment. His mother, played by Naomi Harris, is crack addicted. And he sort of finds a refuge in a drug dealer named Juan, played by, I'm going to shred this name. Mahershala Ali.
Sounds good to me.
And his girlfriend, Teresa, played by Janelle Monáe. And they sort of become these surrogate parents for him, and they sort of teach him all the things that his mother's unable to. And they become this sort of place of exile, or not exile, but refuge for him as he's running away from these bullies and stuff. It jumps in a few years later it's kind of split into third acts, into three acts are sort of almost like little short films unto themselves. So we have the first act where he's a kid and he's learning how to deal with bullies and he meets these drug dealers who end up sort of raising him. The second act deals with him sort of coming of age as a teenager and he's still shy, he's still being teased. And it becomes more and more apparent that his sexual proclivities do not lean heterosexual. And he's sort of developing this crush on a friend of his that's sort of his only ally in the school. And when that relationship sort of furthers, it sort of complicates things more than he realized it would. And then we jump further into the future as they're adults. And he has learned how to completely code switch. He's now not only, you know, dealt with being a wimp or being whatever, but he's now become the paragon of masculinity as this, you know, quiet, brooding gangster type. And he gets a call from this friend that he had as a teenager, and they reconnect as adults living very different lives. Hmm. I was reminded heavily of Richard Linklater's Boyhood, which came out a couple years ago now. And that movie is maybe structurally a little bit more ambitious because he literally made the film with the same cast over a 12-year period. And there's a lot more segments that are kind of bumped together to show this progression of age. But the movies, the two movies essentially have the same kind of structure. And they're both kind of archetypically American in their approach to the coming of age story. And I think both of them do it pretty well. And I think that while there's some similarities here that you'll find in a lot of growing up and coming out movies, especially, I think that this movie does a really good job with the cultural specificity in a way that, you know, indie films are really only allowed to do anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, placing this story in an urban black environment really gives it a kind of a new angle or a new lens to look through as we're looking at stuff like cultural identity versus sexual identity and all of these kind of things. And I think that the movie primarily is sold by the performances. You know, all three actors who play this lead character, and I'm looking for them here, Ashton Sanders, who I think plays him as a teenager, Alex Hibbert, who plays him as a kid. All of the actors do a really good job and really sell the performances, and it's really subtle stuff here, for the most part. I think the only character who is written fairly broadly and in who's acted at just as broadly is this Paula character played by Naomi Harris, who plays a crack-addicted mother. She's kind of giving sort of an Oscar-clippy performance.
Okay.
And she seems a little hungry for it in a way that a much more melodramatic approach than everybody else is taking. You know, all of the actors who approach Chiron, are essentially wordless performances. He's so internal and he's so repressed that he's doesn't get a lot of dialogue throughout the entire film. And who knows if they actually wrote more dialogue for him and they ended up whittling it away in editing because they sort of liked the more of the physicality of the performance by these actors. But that's essentially what we're given here, is we're given everything through the nod of a head or the raise of an eyebrow. And, you know, just as much praise should be given to the actors for being able to portray so much interiority with as little dialogue as possible. The same amount of respect should be given to Barry Jenkins, who is able to portray so much with his camera work. And there's a lot of like one takes and that kind of stuff that we see in a lot of these kind of smart house indie dramas. And there's a definitely a physicality to and a tactility to his environments and maybe some sort of stylistic nods to like early Terrence Malick and that kind of stuff about how the environment sort of informs the characters. But there's the sequence towards the end between older Chiron and his best friend or teenage friend as they're meeting again. It's this long extended conversation set piece that says so much about those characters so subtly without either of them ever saying what they're thinking. And it's some of the best cinema I've seen in all of the year, just this last third of this movie. So I get why it's getting the praise it's getting. I do think if you look at it from a bird's eye point of view, as a genre, it is a coming of age movie pretty standardly. Mm-hmm. And it's probably not going to blow your socks off, but that's not really its intention either. So, yeah, I liked Moonlight, and I think that people who really dig performance-oriented movies are going to like this movie as well. There's one scene in particular where teenage Chiron confronts a bully that had my theater in applause.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right, well, you know, you sold me on this. You sold me a bunch of stuff today, Cassidy. Like, it looks pretty. You said it's mostly actor-driven, but it looks like is that just the trailer showing you the most beautiful shots, like on the beach and stuff? I mean, it looks like it's shot
No, the cinematography is really pretty. That's why I said it, not maybe a visual nod to like early Terrence Malick.
Okay.
Because he does sort of soak in the atmosphere of the sort of the Florida landscape and that kind of stuff. And even like these urban sort of ghettos and stuff are become very painterly. So okay. Yeah, that is a part of an aspect of the movie.
All right, again, you sold me.
Cool. From that, let's get into, I think this also takes place in Florida, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it certainly does.
And I'll let you describe this one as well. What is our Netflix homework?
Okay, Netflix homework is Pervert Park. It is a documentary from a pair from Sweden. Is that where the couple's from? Who are the filmmakers?
Yeah, it says it's from the Swedish film industry or something like that. It was probably made on a grant. Frida Barkfors and Lasse Barkfors.
Yes, I just knew they were a married couple. Mm-hmm. They go to this social program started in Florida. I believe that – see, they never specifically say because I don't think they want people to know exactly where this area is in mm-hmm. Florida. But they call it Pervert Park colloquially and locally. It's a program that Florida launched where to bring a social worker into an environment where there's a trailer park. They bring people who are convicted sex criminals of all stripes, mm-hmm. of all degrees – mm-hmm. And they live in this community where they seem to get some kind of not just treatment in terms of – that's one of the issues I have with the film. I'm not really totally understood of like how this program works. Mm-hmm. Like that was never really well explained. I don't know if that wasn't the purpose of the film. Mm-hmm. But essentially there's a social worker comes and they have very AA-like interventional discussions about their addiction and their problems and facing their problems. Kind of. Mm-hmm. And then the film then is not that interested, I think, in the now I'm kind of giving my opinion here, but then sure. The film follows three or four different characters and figures in the film and explains their crimes and how they're being rehabilitated and how they have kind of lost their way in society. And that's what the film is. It's not what I expected it to be whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But it still touches exactly on what it is. Like, where is the place of sex offenders in society? Like, what do we do with these people?
Right. I think, you know, the movie's asking a lot of tough questions here. And I think that, you know, there's a few themes that they kind of drive home between these character studies or these case studies that are given throughout. And I think, you know, one of them being that sex offenders often come from a history of abuse, mm-hmm. and that it sort of becomes generational.
Can I jump in there 1 second?
Sure.
A lot of that's though, I'm not saying I'm an expert on this, but I do teach high school kids. And I have dealt with CPS a lot, social workers a lot. A lot of that has been debunked recently. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying all of it is. I'm sure it contributes, but like that used to be the same explanation for alcoholism was always that, you know, that was one of the problems I had with the film. It seemed like this is the reason why all these people are sexual predators because they were abused at some point.
Yeah, I'm not saying that.
No, I know. I'm sorry.
Either of our beliefs in the issue, but that's the argument the film's making.
Yeah. Oh, it definitely is. Yes.
And the other one being bad things happen to people. I guess that sounds so dismissive, but bad things happen in society, and that a lot of people who we dismiss in society and we have no use for are still human beings, and they need something out of the justice system on their side.
Right.
And, you know, I think very explicitly the movie says towards the end that, you know, these people should be and need to be humanized. And, you know, these are, like I said, very controversial and very, tough arguments to make, especially, you know, in our culture. And I don't know, I kind of agree with you. I don't know how well the movie really does with arguing either of those points.
I don't think it has a central argument in any way. I mean, I think it poorly attempted to have one, and then it felt like just completely abandoned it midway through. Mm-hmm. And it was like, nah, we're just going to show these people for who they are now. And like, we're not going to have some kind of common theme. Maybe it was my fault. Maybe that wasn't the filmmaker's intention. But I kept looking for some kind of common theme where they're tying it all together. And there were so many. Maybe that was what they wanted. That all this is messy and there's no common solution or, you know, easy silver bullet solution to all this.
Right. So, well, I mean, another argument that the movie teases but doesn't totally commit to is this idea of like the degrees of punishment towards sex offender and what is considered a sex offender and what mm-hmm. isn't considered a sex offender. And, you know, that it can ruin lives the same way, regardless of degree. And, you know, they bring up one case study in particular of a young, like, college graduate kid who, you know, reads comic books and, you know, yeah. that kind of stuff. Like, he's pretty close to some of what we would probably be in our lives. And, you know, he was, by his testimony, lured into a sexting through an online Craigslist ad and ended up getting, what was that show? The Catch a Predator kind of
yep,
thing?
Yep, yep.
That okay. that kind of a situation. And I from this side of the screen, if you're just watching the story as it unfolds, yeah, it sounds like the kid got a raw deal. But if you're on the other side of the story, I feel it's hard to say with any of these stories because we're only getting testimony what we're not hearing.
Okay. Yes, I agree. But can I say a lot of things, including that one?
Yes.
Do you believe any of the subjects that they're telling you the whole truth of anything that happened to them?
No.
I don't either.
And it's not because I think that they're like sociopathic liars or anything like that. I think in some cases there's some stories where they don't really have to say a whole lot more. I mean, I will say that they do at least, they've never said anything like, none of them, with the exception of that kid, none of them ever said like, I shouldn't be here. Or I am not a sex offender, or, you know, and some of the stories are heartbreaking, and especially the way that they're told as testimony.
Right.
But they are worded in such a way that it's to build empathy.
I even wonder if that's true because early on with every one of their stories,
mm-hmm.
the first interview you get with their story, I felt empathy for every single one of them. Like, oh yeah, that must have been really tough. It didn't sound that bad. And then as they became more comfortable with the filmmaker,
mm-hmm.
including the two I found the most unnerving and absolutely disturbing was the one guy who was flat out frightening was the guy who just picked up the girl from Mexico and just the little girl and tried to rape her just because he wanted to do it. I mean, that guy is clearly a danger to everyone and admitted himself. I mean, he even says at one point himself, he should never be around people. I mean, like he doesn't even know why he's there in that place, period. But the guy who says, you know, the story of the girl walking, the little girl walking in and, you know, caught him masturbating.
Mm-hmm.
And then the story changes later to another little girl sees him and he masturbated in front of her.
Mm-hmm.
All of their stories are ramping up in terms of severity. The woman's story turns into an absolute nightmarish horror story.
Right.
At the end. All of them, I just kept thinking, boy, the problem I have with them is the way that is the they're describing what they do. I mean, they're horrific and you have this internal revulsion to think that anyone who could do that to a child's revolting. But I tried to get over that.
Yeah.
But what they tried to structure it as if it was NA or AA,
mm-hmm.
where everyone goes and, like it or not, one of the things that I think is important to recovery, where everyone says who goes into recovery, is you have to admit you have a problem. Right. And that you're powerless to stop it. And you are the one ultimately responsible for it. But in every single one of their testimonies, when they're working with that social worker and he kind of leads them on at points,
mm-hmm.
it's all you put yourself in that situation to do that with that girl. Like you could avoid that situation instead of there was never any like, don't you see how that does not fit in the norms of society? And right. maybe we need to recorrect those behaviors. Maybe this is my interpretation of the film, but it seemed like a lot of excuse making and a lot of searching for answers to doing really horrific things. And right. I was a little unnerved that there was a lot of not excuse making, but I don't know. There didn't seem to be a lot of bearing down to the root of the problem
mm-hmm.
that, you know, what you're doing is not normative to behavior. It was a lot of just them admitting that it was bad. Okay, clearly it's bad, but then it just seemed to die at that.
Right. Well, I think the way that they, based upon what we're seeing, and you're right in that the movie is a lot more interested in sort of the emotional storytelling aspect yes. of it than it is with dealing with like how does this program actually logistically run.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the issues that the way that they seem to approach this their problems or this counselor that's kind of going there and talking to them every day is talking about root causes,
mm-hmm.
which is like kind of goes all the way back to sort of what's the word, like Freudian psychology,
yeah,
kind of stuff, which is again soft science at best.
Yeah,
and then so talking a lot about root causes, and then like AA, talking a lot about triggers.
Yes.
So it's less about like what. It's less about talking about the victims, less about talking about the nature of victimizing.
Yes.
Because it's really, really difficult to look at the especially when it comes to pedophiles, and not all of these people in this film are pedophiles. But when you think about pedophilia, and this comes up a lot in terms of the LGBT struggle, because for a long time they were kind of cast to the side as being the same thing. It's just a sexual aberration. And, you know, if we allow them to marry or do whatever, then eventually it's going to lead to us accepting pedophiles.
That's a slippery slope argument.
Yeah.
That was rolled out. You know, I get what you're saying.
And to, you know, clean white straight America, it was a pretty convincing argument for a lot of years. And I think one of the reasons why I think everyone should see documentaries like this, or should be able to stomach the subject matter of dealing with what pedophilia really is to be able to clearly make those distinctions. The biggest one is this is a sexual proclivity that leads to antisocial behavior and leads to victimization.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you know, the long and the short of it. And it's an issue that I feel like the movie, I mean, the fact that we never even talk to in this documentary, we never talk to any of the victims.
Right.
We never see them. And I understand, like, maybe that isn't what the movie wanted to be about. And that isn't, the movie isn't here to condemn anybody. And I think that in some regards, to do a film like this, that is an approach that should be commended, because.
Yep. I agree.
Otherwise, then you just have a PSA and.
Yep.
You know. A polemic documentary that's not very interesting. So I don't know. I think this movie's worth seeing just to be able to expose yourself to difficult questions and to be able to ask those questions to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But I do agree that there is a narrative that is a little slippery and not entirely intellectually honest.
And that was my big takeaway. Like there's like glimpses of stuff that I thought that I could connect with when a guy was talking about, kind of in the line what you said, being homosexual and struggling with that, and then
right, he himself, who should know better, conflates the two,
yes,
and says, yes, like, well, if I had been able to, and I've heard that, you know, apologies to any Catholic listeners, but you hear the, like, oh, well, if the priests were allowed to marry, then they wouldn't do this stuff. Right. And he says in the documentary, if I had been able to accept myself as a homosexual and been able to find what I really wanted, not try and be straight with this woman, then I wouldn't have had sex with these 8-year-old boys.
Right.
That's not a lot of people's stories.
Exactly. And then it's that. And the thing that started was the social worker, there's no questioning of how any of that was crazy. Like, even in terms of, like, I'll take that and give the straight equivalent of it. When the college kid said, you know, he was on Craigslist and it was an undercover cop.
Right.
And it was a 30-year-old woman he thought he was talking to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a straight, horny guy at 22, if someone said, hey, I want to see you also come over and have sex with my 14-year-old daughter, like, there would be so many alarm bells, even at 22, going off in my head when someone said that to me. Even if in some dark corner of my mind, I thought, oh, yeah, maybe I want to try that. The fact that he was willing to go through with it and do it anyway, like, and then there was no, like, the social worker never questions him. And like, well, why did you go through with that anyway? If you knew it was, you know, something you should have done, like, they just leave it at that. And I feel like saying, like, well, why the hell didn't you ask the guy, you know, why didn't he, you know, it's such a – not impartial of showing all of the scope of people involved.
Right.
But just of a – such a snapshotly done documentary that you're left with all these teases and then just moves on to the next person.
Yeah. And there's a lot of situations where we're not hearing the whole story.
Yes.
We're hearing their story as told by them. And like I said, a lot of that stuff is really compelling and heartbreaking. It is. And you are glued to the screen as they're, you know, telling these sob stories, literally sobbing. And it's really difficult stuff. And, you know, some of them are brutally honest. but I there's details that exist around the fringes of these stories, like such as how could the kid make the logical leap of this woman wants me to have sex with her 14-year-old daughter?
Right.
Now, if we're getting into like the greater opinion stuff about, you know, policy, I don't believe that those kind of sting operations should exist.
No, I think they're gross.
And who knows if this kid had never been presented with such an opportunity that he would ever entertain the thought.
Right.
But you know, yeah, the situation is what it is, and I think maybe the documentary isn't necessarily, like I said, it's not out to condemn.
Right.
And maybe it's showing it for what it is with no editorial gesturing anywhere in the film so that we could have these conversations.
No, it's true. And the biggest question is then, and this is what I thought when I first sat down to watch it, I thought, and which I think is probably one of the most difficult conversations we're going to have in 21st century Western society, what the hell do we do with these people in general? Like, yeah. What do you do with a repeat offender pedophile? There's a movement that comes out of, strangely, out of like the high school level. Have you ever heard of restorative justice?
No.
Okay, restorative justice is the idea that instead of condemning someone for committing a horrible crime, mm-hmm. you make them face the victims, mm-hmm. and you sit down, and the victims have their say in front of the person. They do it in like South Africa. They do it in a lot of things with you know, gangs, inter-gang problems. And they do it a lot of things in high schools when kids have fights. Because a lot of kids conflate bullying with having an individual fight with another kid.
Yeah.
That they might be on the losing end of it. And then if they cry bullying, it triggers, I mean, I'm not trying to say like social war triggers, but it triggers all kinds of alarms in the school system now, mm-hmm. where you have to investigate it and you have to say, okay, is this really bullying or is this two kids having an ongoing dispute and one's just losing the dispute either physically or online?
Right.
The idea is to have restorative justice and you sit down and the kids talk about, okay, if that's two kids who fought one time, that makes sense. If that's someone who robbed a liquor store and beat up someone, but like, I don't like that whole concept of, you know, we're punishing people and punishment is bad. Maybe it's not even their problem. Maybe there's something chemically wrong with them, but mm-hmm. it doesn't make them less of a threat, you know, to the greater whole. But geez, what do you do to those people humanely? Mm-hmm. I mean, is it humane to sit down and set them in front of their victim and make them, their victim, listen to all their, you know, them talk to them? I don't know if that's humane, but
it's difficult to say. And I think it's difficult to say whether or not that even would be an effective program.
Right, exactly.
Because some of these people, and I don't think all of the people in this movie, but some of these kinds of sex offenders, especially pedophiles who engage with like, you know, younger than like teenage and that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. We're talking about sociopathic behavior. We're talking about right. like they do not connect on a normal emotional level.
Right.
And a lot of times, a somewhat maybe better documentary on the subject, though it's a lot less cinematically presented. Mm-hmm. You know who Louis Theroux is?
Yeah, I do.
He did those Weird Weekends, and he did the documentary with the Westboro Baptist Church, and
yep.
most recently he did one for Scientology. He did a documentary like this where he hung out at a psych ward for sex abusers. Mm. Sex offenders, and he has that kind of candid way of just asking questions and mm-hmm. just letting the people explain from their point of view, and then he keeps prodding them with questions and questions and questions. And you know, I think that documentary kind of shows that some of these people, like, because that he would introduce the people, his documentary subjects at the beginning, and they would have these similar kinds of sob stories or these similar kinds of, this is what I did, this is why I'm convicted, this is how I'm trying to get better. Mm-hmm. And then later on, he would stay with them for a week, and later on he would say, oh, so-and-so just got in trouble, let's go and talk to him and see what happened. And you would see, like, you know, this person who explained his story at the beginning is like, yeah, well, they found these pictures under my bed, and, you know, I didn't think it was a big deal, but I guess it's not allowed. And so you realize it's like some of the stuff that they say is practiced.
Oh, yeah.
And if given the opportunity to groom, they will.
Yeah, exactly.
And that sounds so like,
it sounds gross.
Knee-jerk and militaristic, but.
Right. But is it really? I mean, these aren't like, I mean, a drunk driver is dangerous behind the wheel, mm. right? Because he can hurt other people. Right. Someone who then instead but is a drunk who never gets in the car and drives anywhere and just drinks themselves to death, are they a threat? I mean, they're threats to themselves, clearly, right? But, you know, like...
This isn't a victimless crime in the same way.
Right, exactly. Exactly. It's not someone abusing drugs and not, you know, robbing or killing for it and killing themselves. It's harming the most... Probably, I mean, these are, you know, when we talk about children, especially those who usually are abused, are the most marginalized members of society have always been children because they're not citizens. They don't have any kind of rights. They're just these little things until in Western society, especially until they're 18 years old.
Right.
I mean, if you can't protect those and you can't be stringent about protecting those people in your society, what are you really protecting at some point?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we must march them into the sea. That's not what I'm saying. I don't think you can approach this as rival gang members having beef where they can sit down and do a sort of justice and talk it out. This is not that. And when we start to, again, I'm going to point to the election. When we start to normalize very abnormal behavior and pretend that it's real, candidate wantonly talks about nuclear weapons and like love for dictators around the world. Like, that's not a normal thing. People like, and to have this false equivalency that, you know, one is equal to the other is a really dangerous road that I really fear in America that we just kind of want to paint everything with this A and B brush and that there's never a dissection of the problem. I don't know. I don't know where I went on this rant.
I'm with you. That's why I was a little leery to do the documentary at all. I thought it would bring up a very interesting conversation, but the problem, especially when you're talking about treatment and you're talking about recovery, these conversations are always circular. And
yes, exactly.
Unfortunately, you can't make a broad brushstroke over like a sex offender is a sex offender is a sex offender because the natures of the crimes can be different and can vary. And in some cases, there are some, frankly, I think bullshit cases of the 18-year-old who's sleeping with the 16-year-old and they both go to high school together.
But you know what, Cassie? We didn't see that with these people, though.
No.
You know what I mean? We didn't see that. We saw predatory sex offenders. These weren't, these were, you know, not that you're, I don't know what the class, the hell class they are, C class or class ones or whatever the hell they're called, the ones who urinate in public or, you know, the Romeo and Juliet stuff. These were people who, you know, did things to minors or violently attacked other people and raped other people. This wasn't, you know, so I don't know. I don't know.
I think you and Dennis should have an episode about this very subject.
Oh, Christ. You're reading our mind. We've bandied this one about for about a year.
But it's so dark, it's hard to go into.
We're so scared to do it. We don't want to sound like I said, like march them into the sea.
Right.
Or, you know, like, it's just such an ugly, like, we wanted to do one, like, what do you do what do you do in a society? Like, I always think, like, if you watch Star Trek, right? And they show this world without needs, and they have no need for money, and they have no need for, you know, racial strife, and they have no need for food anymore because they have the transporters and the materializer materializes food. I always want to see, what the hell did you do with all the sociopaths? What'd you do with all the pedophiles? What'd you do with all the unrepentant bigots who just won't reform? Were they just all euthanized? Did you just I'm serious. Like you don't see them in a Star Trek universe. And how do you get to that utopia when you're always going to have that population that just is not going to fit in the utopia? What do we do with it?
You might be right. And from that, I think that's going to be the show.
Star Trek Eugenics ends the show.
But before I go and read off all of my credits and everything about how to find our show, how do people find your shows?
Okay, for Make Dad Read Comics, which is all about me and my dad reading comic books, each week we read a different book. We read Doctor Strange last week. I think we're reading Spider-Man Election Day next week, tie in with the election. You can find that on Make Dad Read Comics. Just type that into Google. You'll find it anywhere. There's a blog spot that I barely maintain. I have assumed that now we have really kind listeners who send us food and comic books via mail. I don't need to have a website anymore. Like, I've reached my peak of the show. It's never going to get any bigger than that. For Almost Educational, there's actually a website that Dennis pointed up the money and helped put together, so I let him do it.
It's a really slick website, I have to
is
say.
It?
Yeah, I like it a lot.
Well, thank you. Give most of the credit to him. I barely maintain it. So that's Dennis's contribution. We're both teachers. We sit down with a thought experiment. What would it be like? The geopolitics of colonization of outer space be like? What would the alternate history of a merger of the AFL-NFL be like? What happens if Martin Luther King was never killed? And then sometimes we just talk about things we'd like to talk about in classroom. We can't. It seems to have dived deep into politics. Like we're talking about what would happen if the, I think it's the Maybach Act in 1969 went through that abolished the Electoral College that was voted down. What if that came after Watergate, which I think people would have said, hell yeah, let's do that. Would that have killed gerrymandering the Electoral College? What would that look like if we just went by the popular vote? That's our topic next week. And we've tried to be more civil on the show instead of shouting and debating each other. There's also less alcohol involved in some of those shows, which probably helped to like, we're lightweight. So even like a beer or two, we're yelling at each other. So we stopped doing that. But yeah, there's enough yelling in the election so that we don't need to yell. So that was the other part of the show. So you can find that Almost Educational anywhere you want to find that. There's a website for that. So those are the two shows.
Mm-hmm. And I love both shows. And I think that you both shows entertain me on completely different levels.
Oh, good.
And I think that you've been able to find very natural co-hosts with two people that you've had in your regular life. And yeah, I suggest anybody who likes this show or likes what they've heard from you on our show to definitely go check out both of those podcasts.
The supernova would be if I had Dennis and Dad in the same room to record a show.
That would be.
But I have no idea in a Venn diagram of anything that would...
How that would ever happen.
No, I don't. I really don't know.
Well, your dad used to be a cop if you discussed, like, you know, police policy over the years or something.
That'd
like
be interesting. Well, I'll tell you what, they both helped me move multiple times and had to move comic book boxes with me.
Yeah.
And they both hate the long boxes and still mock me about, we had to carry, at one point, we had to carry 20 long boxes into a moving van. I felt bad.
Right,
but,
right.
Like, so they have that in common, but that would be a very long show.
If you like everything you've heard here and you want to email the show and I choose to read it, I did not do with Patrick because we ended up going on like a 5-week hiatus right after you sent that email. You can do so at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Facebook at our Facebook group, facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can follow us on Twitter @jabberpodcast, and I post the episodes there. Sometimes I post like questions to the listeners and that kind of stuff. You can find us and subscribe to us at iTunes or Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, and the Windows Podcast Network. I'm trying to get on Google Play, but that's a little bit more difficult than...
I got a way. I'll email you something if you want it.
Yeah, you might have to. I haven't checked in a while. I might be on there. I'm not sure. You can read my weekly reviews that I do for the Idaho State Journal at saladworkreviews.blogspot.com. I usually post those on my personal Twitter, @BCCassidy. As well as my Facebook, which I'm not going to share. You can read some of the movie reviews and content I provided for the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at MacGuff.in/author/Cassidy. A friend of the show, Brad Decker, who I saw over the weekend over at Kamikaze, he came down from the Bay Area where he's just taking a teaching position at a high school over there. He still runs his entertainment/literature blog, panelandframe.com. And friends of both of ours, who we've also collaborated with, Rod and Denise, you should also go listen to their podcast, The Listening Party. And I think that's it. I think that's the show. Thanks for coming on, Patrick.
Thank you. The plugs are the best part.
I'm sure that's what everybody loves to listen to me rattle off something I have written here in a Word document.
I like it.
Good. Talk to you later.
Bye.